Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, and thank you for listening. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have lines open right now, waiting for you, just glistening in the sun, waiting for you to go over there and get one of them. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I have a serious question for you.
Uh-oh.
No, it's a serious question.
Okay. Lay it on me.
Okay. Have you ever been gored by a bison?
Nope. No, I've avoided that somehow.
Not even once?
Not even once.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Have you?
Actually, I never have had that experience. I've never been gored by a bison. But a Colorado man, 34 years old, he was sent to the hospital because he was gored by a bison at Yellowstone National Park. The second person to have been gored at the popular park in the past month. That's why I was wondering if it's ever happened to you, because he's not the only one.
I thought the park was closed. Didn't they? Where were the floodings? Maybe I'm mixing up parks.
No, that you're right. That was part of it. We covered that a week or two ago. Roads have been closed and a lot of damage, especially to the roads. So I think that it's not accessible to the general public. But here's the backstory. So park officials say that this 34-year-old man who was gored by a bison at the Giant Geyser Old Faithful, at the time the man and his family were walking on the boardwalk when the bison charged the group. The family didn't immediately leave the area. By the way, here's a pro tip. If you're like in an area and there's a bull bison charging your group, probably a good idea to immediately leave the area. At least that's my hunch.
No kidding. Yeah. It's like the haunted house movies where it's like the ghost is like, get out. I won't leave. Yeah. Leave the house.
No, first I have to go down into the basement in the dark to see what's right down there before I can leave.
Well, make sure you send the kids to the attic because there's right probably something important up there too.
Yeah.
So the family didn't running at you.
Yeah, he's charging the family. The family doesn't leave. So the bison continues to charge, and eventually he gores the man. Park officials say that bison are unpredictable. And they can run three times faster than you can. Three times faster than you can. They recommend staying more than 25 yards away from all large animals, including elk, bighorn sheep, deer, moose, coyotes, etc. If needed, turn around and go the other way. This is like, you know, obvious get out of the area kind of advice. So anyway, I just wondered if, because it seems awfully foolhardy to do that, if you ask me.
Is he okay? Did you get that far?
I mean, it doesn't say that his injuries are life-threatening.
Oh, that's good.
I'm sure they're painful. I can't imagine, you know, what it would feel like to get a horn through your stomach.
That's a painful lesson learned.
Yeah, I'll say. So just FYI, if you ever go to Yellowstone, Cyrus, and a bison starts charging your family, good idea to get out of the area.
Thank you. Man, yeah. These lessons that I get on the show are...
I know. Where else are you going to get information like this?
Life-saving.
What other Catholic radio show covers such topics? None.
Weird.
888-914-9149. I see people piling in. Actually, one person just fell off the vine. Sometimes I think the cell signals don't always stick. But we do have lines right now, 888-914-9149. Let us go to some phones. I'm sorry, to some emails. I have one here from Trent, came in this morning, listening in Mesa, Arizona. Hi, Patrick. Please speak on this article I just read in the Catholic News Service by Hannah Brockhaus. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reportedly received communion at a Mass with Pope Francis at the Vatican on Wednesday. Pelosi took communion, according to sources present at the Mass. What do you want me to say? What can I say, Trent? There's nothing really to say. The other day I talked, it might have been yesterday, I talked about the scandalous antics of people like Nancy Pelosi, who are publicly Catholic, and they make their Catholicity public at every step, or at least whenever it suits them. and they receive communion with impunity. And in her case, even after her archbishop, Archbishop Corleone, had told her not to. So what is there for me to say? You know, it's amazing, it's sad, but what can I do? There's really nothing more to say, honestly, Trent. I use an analogy. I'll share this with you. I use an analogy of the Titanic. This is helpful to me. Maybe it'll be helpful to you. If you were on the Titanic and it had hit the iceberg and it's taking on water and you know that it's going to go down, it doesn't seem to me to be beneficial to anybody to go yell at the captain or go yell at the guys on the bridge who didn't see the...
This is your Titanic music.
I'm just going to wait for this to happen, and then I'll do it. I don't want to interrupt this.
Oh, you got to tell your story.
I will.
This is here it comes. It's background music.
All right. Okay, pipe it down. So using this analogy of the Titanic, if the ship has hit the iceberg, and I'm not saying that the Catholic Church is going down or anything like that, because it can't. It won't. It hasn't for 2,000 years. Jesus is in charge of his church, and he permits it to go through certain difficulties. That's his decision to allow this to happen. But in any case, if you use this analogy and things look really bad, or you see things that are bothersome, let's say, it doesn't seem to me to be beneficial to go yell at the captain or the guys with the binoculars who should have been looking out for icebergs a little bit better than they did. I mean, what's the point in publicly shouting at them or blaming them? I mean, who does that do any good for? Nobody, if you ask me. So my advice would be focus on getting to a lifeboat. Focus on helping people who need help. That seems to be a much better use of time. And it's for that reason that when stories like this come up, rather than dwell on it endlessly, as some people do, I would prefer to try to do work that's going to be more helpful to people in the here and now. That's my take on it. Thank you. This email comes in from Don in Los Angeles, listening on our 93 KHJ station. He says, "Hi, Patrick. I just heard the Devil's Den caller, and I thought I'd like to hear your thoughts on my own not entirely dissimilar situation. I'm a professional musician working in Los Angeles and recently was offered a pretty fair job playing with an 80s band who has a sizable couple of hits. As I was getting ready for my first gig with this band, I noticed that there was a song on the set list which mentioned a euphemism for Satan in the song title. I didn't think much of it until I listened to the song several times. I can't say how serious they are about their devotion to the satanic, but the content was graphic enough for me to immediately back out of the job. I did not go into details when I spoke to them, but simply told them that I had a conflict and I wouldn't be able to do the upcoming gigs. What are your thoughts? Good jobs with the established bands are beyond rare in my business, and I was sick to my stomach to have to pass up this opportunity, but I just couldn't imagine standing in front of audiences playing guitar while the singer was singing about how Satan is his friend, or is a friend. Am I being overly scrupulous? Should I have just taken the job? Thanks." And No, I don't think you're being overly scrupulous. I think you're being a stand-up guy because you had an opportunity to have a nice payday. I'm sure it would have been really nice money. And to also add to your resume the fact that you had played as a session musician with this band. So if you didn't mention who the band is, but if they're that well known and they've got some big enough hits, probably everybody would know who they are. That's a nice thing to put on your resume. So you were a stand-up guy and you said, I'm going to stand up for my faith and not go along to get along and not take the money and run, knowing that one of the songs you'd have to play would be seriously problematic. So no, I don't think you're being overly scrupulous. I admire you for doing what you did. Not a lot of people would do that, honestly. A lot of people, for whatever reason, rationalizing, you know, they would just say, well, you know, I'll just overlook it. It's just one song. And it's not really that serious anyway. And I need the money. And look, I'm playing with this band. Who gets to do that? And they would have just gone along to get along. So no, I think you did the right thing. And I'm really glad you actually sent me a note, because it gives me an opportunity to share this with the listening audience, because all of us at one time or another are going to get into situations where you have to make a decision. Am I going to compromise on something that I believe is important, or am I going to take the hit and do what's right? And you did what's right, if you ask me. So kudos to you. And that reminds me of a situation that I went through. I'll just share that for good measure, only because, you know, since we're talking about our own individual situations, here's what happened to me. In the business world, one of the ways in which you can earn money is to, if you have a large mailing list, you can rent that mailing list. And there are, you know, companies that have an affinity to what you do who maybe are interested in sending a catalog or sending something, because they know that the people on your mailing list are likely to be interested in the things that they might want to sell or to let you know about. So just so happens, back in the day, and this is going back years, I had a very large mailing list. And it was customary to have a mailing service company to rent these to various like-minded and approved organizations. So it's not just like for anybody, it would be, you know, so let's say if Ignatius Press wanted to rent my list, I would approve them because we're like-minded. Their project is like my project. We're trying to promote the faith. So I get this request from the mailing company to rent the entire list. Now that's, you know, that's a lot of names, and that means a lot of money. And this publishing company wants to rent the entire list, which is great, because you don't typically get that. Usually it's a segmented, you know, amount, like we want to rent 10,000 or we want to rent 5,000. In this case, they wanted the whole thing. So that was really cool. And then I started looking at what it is that they wanted to promote, and it was the writing some books of a certain priest. Now, I wasn't familiar with him, but I thought maybe I might have heard his name somewhere, but I didn't really know anything about him. And I thought, well, you know, ignorance is bliss. But I just had this funny feeling that there's something about that priest. I just remember somewhere that it wasn't quite right, or there was some problem with it, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So honestly, I was very tempted to just bury that concern and go forward with it and send back the approval and then wait for them to send me a nice big check 30 days later. And I didn't, because I thought, I just need to check. So I called up a priest friend of mine who is in the same religious order as that priest, whose books they wanted to promote. And I asked him, I just said, what can you tell me about Father X? And he groaned. And he said, that guy's just off the rails. He's bad news, and the stuff that he's promoting isn't compatible with the gospel. And I said, are you sure? You sure you got the right guy? Is it possible you're thinking of somebody? I said, no, this guy definitely bad news. So I thought, okay, well, that's enough to cinch the deal. But then I thought, I better get a second opinion, because I was trying to find a way to make this work. So I called another priest, different part of the country, and I asked him the same question. I got the same reaction. No. This guy's got all kinds of problems with his theology. It's bad news. So he didn't know that the other priest had told me that, but he had the same reaction. So that's when I knew he was at a fork in the road. I realized I have to make a decision, knowing now, because it's been verified to me, that this priest's books are going to be bad for people and lead them astray. And yet there's this big money out there that all I have to do to get that is just say yes. That's all I have to do. I don't have to endorse it. I don't have to do anything. Just wait for the check to arrive. And I'll tell you, I was very tempting. But I knew deep down inside, you know, in your heart of hearts, where you know, and you just know that you know, that if you do this, it's going to be wrong. So I
wrote
back.
I don't want that on my karmic record.
No, I really don't.
No, you really don't. Nor did I want it on my karmic record. So I wrote an email back to the publishing company, and instead of saying, yes, it's approved, I said, no, it's not approved. I can't accept this particular one. And they got back to me like right away, because they make money on these things too. That's how they make money. And they said, are you kidding? You're not going to rent your list? I said, no, I'm not going to do it. So within, I don't know, it seemed like within an hour or so, as I remember, the president of the publishing company that had sent the order into the list rental company, he gets in touch with me. you know, Mr. Madrid, there must be some mistake. I don't know what's going on. I'm not sure why you would say no. He's a respected theologian and he's written many books and people know him all over the world. And I'm sure there must be some misunderstanding here. And he was really trying to, you know, hustle me into saying yes to rent this list. And I said, well, from what I understand from various sources that I trust, there are problems with his work. And I'm going to have to decline. I apologize, but I'm going to have to decline. Thank you very much. And that was the end of it. And he was kind of miffed. So that was that. That was it. Until maybe 2 weeks went by. Cyrus, I kid you not on this. Maybe 2 weeks went by, and it was all over the Catholic news that the Vatican, and this was under, who would it have been? Must have been Pope Benedict, I believe, that the Vatican had publicly condemned the writings of this particular priest. Wow. And he had been, you know, his books were discredited in that way. And the Vatican, under the authority of the Pope, said, do not listen to this guy. Do not read his books. He doesn't preach the Catholic faith. And I breathe a sigh of relief, because I thought to myself, how would I have felt if I had done the wrong thing and given in to the temptation to cut a corner here just to make a buck, only to find out that this book catalog by this priest, who 2 weeks later was going to be condemned, you know, his writings, not him, by the church, that would not have been a very comfortable feeling for me. So there's my story. That's good. Show and tell today.
So if it's like we're constantly walking up to a fork in the road, and you can choose the right way or the wrong way. And mm-hmm. we're given that option over and over again. But if you go the right way, you are rewarded. Whereas if you go the wrong way, it becomes easier to walk that wrong path.
And to keep walking down that path.
Right.
You're right. It becomes easier to compromise. The more, and really I think too, the little compromises are like termites. They're working in the background. You don't really notice them. But if you have a habit of compromising on little things over and over and over again, when the big things come up, you're easily going to fall. You're easily going to compromise because you're so used to it. But getting in the habit or the stable disposition of not compromising, that will help you always more and more take the right way to go when you reach those forks in the road. So there's my story. I'd like to hear your story. Give me a call. It doesn't have to be about that, obviously. What's on your mind? 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. The gentleman who wrote to me, the musician in L.A., if you want to write back to me, I hope you heard my commentary on this. Just between you and me, I'd be curious to know who the band is, honestly. I'll be right back.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Haven't heard this song in a while. 888-914-9149. I want to just make note of an email that I received this morning from Joanne. Joanne, you know who you are, listening in Sacramento. And your email was about my commentary on E. Michael Jones. And your email is far too long for me to be able to read on the air. But I'll just tell you right now, the reason I answered the way I did, your cynicism notwithstanding, is that when somebody calls up and asks about a certain personality, whoever that personality may be, if, number one, as I truthfully said on the air, I am not as familiar with that person as I would need to be able to comment intelligently on it, it's better for me not to comment I don't know why you didn't accept my answer that when I said that. But also, if there are what appear to be legitimate criticisms of a person's work or, you know, his, I don't know, attitudes on certain topics, sometimes it's the more charitable thing to do to not enter into airing out that so-called dirty laundry in public. So I recognize, because you put it in your email, that you have high regard for his work. Great. That's fine. More power to you. I did not dismiss him in a manner that you say you now find typical of Catholic leadership. I reject that premise entirely. So I think you are being cynical and maybe a bit hard-hearted because you don't like the fact that there was an opportunity for me to criticize somebody and I didn't take it. Or there was an opportunity for me to discuss the merits or demerits of somebody's books or work and I didn't take it because I'm not familiar enough with them and it wouldn't be fair to do so. So I would suggest you look in the mirror and examine your own heart on this issue. I think you're overreacting, and you certainly missed the point or the reason behind why I said what I said. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Tim now in Highland, Indiana. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Patrick. My question is, I was either yesterday or the day before, you were talking about why we don't see miracles in the present day as much as we did, say, in apostolic times. And you right. said it, was it St. Augustine who yes. said that the reason why we don't see it is because it's not necessary?
That's
can you
right.
tell me exactly where I can find that?
You know, Google is your friend. If you Google it, you'll find it. It's easy to find.
Yeah, I tried it. I couldn't find it. How do I search for it?
Oh, well, I mean, the way I would search for it is I would go to the volumes in my library of the Church Fathers. Not everybody has those, but that's where I would go.
Yeah, I don't have those.
Okay. So it was one of his polemical interactions with a heretic. It might have been one of the Donatists that he was writing a polemical back and forth with. And the essence of the other side's argument was, you're not really representing the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church, as started by Jesus and the apostles, had miracles. And these miracles were the proofs that this was the church that Jesus started. And your church, Augustine, doesn't have these miracles. You're not raising people from the dead or anything like that. So that was the context of it. So what I would do is, maybe I can do this after the show is over, is just go to the section. I don't remember which of his polemical writings it was in. But I do know that it is mentioned at some length in a book by Frederick Vandermeer called Augustine the Bishop. You probably don't have that book either. I don't blame you, because it's a long and very sort of scholarly sort of look at Augustine's life. But it's mentioned in there as well. So how about this, Tim? Why don't I do a little bit of homework, and in the next day or so, I can quote it for you so that you know exactly where it is.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. I'll put that on my to-do list. Thank you. Let's go to E. Frank now in Astoria, New York. Good morning, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning, Patrick. I have a question that entails canon law of the church.
Okay.
But first, I would just like to say...
You know I'm not a canon lawyer, right? You know I'm...
Right.
I can offer my thoughts or opinions, but I don't have any canon law expertise. So just be forewarned.
All right. Well, anyway, you know, my parents were baptized and confirmed outside the United States. One came as an emigrant, one came as an immigrant. And basically, I've had problems of discrimination and alienation all my life here in the United States, because basically they said to me back in 1971, they told my parents, do not baptize your child. He does not need to be baptized, because you are two Catholic parents. You come from a Catholic lineage. All of your relatives and ancestors were basically Catholic. Mm-hmm. So there's no need to go through the trouble of baptizing your son in the United States. But nevertheless, they decided to baptize me. Then I received First Holy Communion as a catechumen CCD student for the basic 2 years here in my local diocese, and then a few years later, I was confirmed Catholic while I attended parochial school. But, you know, they have...
So, Frank, E. Frank, do me a favor. How would you summarize this in a question? Sounds like you're leading up to something.
Okay. Are you there, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, my question is, under Canaan law, if you are not have received any type of sacraments or have any form of sacramental life, is it advisable for you yourself to enter the Catholic Church or tell others to enter the Catholic Church? Is it legal or acceptable for anyone who is not involved or is not baptized in the church? Can they actually enter the church?
Oh, without doubt. If that were not true, then nobody could enter the church because all of us begin as unbaptized folk. None of us is born Catholic. We're all born as pagans. So, yes, the answer is the church desires and is cheerfully, happily welcoming anybody who wants to come into the church, the doorway into which is the sacrament of baptism. So, were you yourself baptized? I kind of got lost in the details there. You did get baptized, right, when you were a kid?
Yes, it was infant baptism up to the 365 days.
Okay, but the fact is you were baptized, I presume, in a Catholic church, right?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Did you receive any of the other sacraments of initiation, confirmation, say, and the Holy Eucharist?
Yes, First Holy Communion as a CCD student, and then confirmation in the regular church from a parochial school. I did a project, okay. And I went on a retreat, and I was confirmed a few weeks later.
Okay, great. So you have received your sacraments of initiation. You are a fully initiated Catholic, and that's why I was not really sure where you were going with this. Are you wondering about this for yourself? Because there's no need to wonder. You're already fully initiated into the church. Or are you wondering about people who are not baptized and whether or not they should become Catholic?
Well, yeah. The problem is that I have many Baptist friends who wish to enter the church, mm-hmm. and they have informed me, they told me that there was a convert who took rites for Christian initiation for adults. She was from the Baptist faith, but she became a full-fledged Catholic. Uh-huh. And they told me one day that they don't understand why she's acting irrationally on the streets and screaming at people, that they're afraid that they don't want to enter the church as Baptists to find out if they want conversion into the church. They refuse to enter and they're afraid, so they're asking me, as a confirmed Catholic, if I have any knowledge of why that happens.
Well, I'm not sure I can help with that. Who knows what's going on in that lady's life? It could be she may have some mental illness. Who knows? But that is not something that should sway somebody one way or the other, for that matter, regarding coming into the Catholic Church. She could have a mental illness. She could be needing medications that she's not getting. It could be a spiritual or personality issue. But none of those things would affect the decision of somebody else to become a Catholic. So maybe that's the message you can share with them. Just, you know, this is the church that Christ established. Warts and all, problems and all. We have plenty of problems in the Catholic Church, no doubt. But it's still the church. It's like the Ark of Noah. Not a very pleasant place to be, but I'd rather be on the Ark of Noah than in the middle of the flood. And so come on in. The water's terrible. That's what I would tell them. Thanks, E. Frank. Let's go to John now in Albuquerque. Good morning, John.
Yeah, hi, Patrick. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Good morning.
Okay. I have a couple of Protestant friends who attend the Evangelical Church, and they tell me that the preacher has told them since they've been born again, they know that they're saved. They have 100% certitude that they're saved. And I was just wondering how you would answer that.
Oh, well, I would say, first of all, the Bible does not teach that you have absolute certitude of salvation. In fact, you could point out what St. Paul says to them, and really to all of us, in Romans chapter 11. If you go there, I'm just turning to it here right now, you'll see him describing the Israelites who lost their salvation. And you want to begin reading about verse 11. And he describes
11, okay.
them. Yeah, so Romans 11, beginning of verse 11, and it's a lengthy passage, so you just want to read all the way to the end to get the context. But what he does in this passage is he describes Israel as a cultivated olive tree, and he's talking about their salvation and how some of the Jews at the time of Christ lost their salvation because they rejected Jesus as their Messiah. They refused to believe in him. And he says those were like branches that were snapped off because of their disbelief, because they rejected Jesus. They lost their salvation. They were snapped off. And then he proceeds to talk, because he's speaking here, he's writing here, to these Gentile Christians. So they were not Jewish, they were Gentiles. These are the Romans. And he's writing to them, and he's saying, you guys are like shoots from a wild olive tree. And you have your branches have been grafted in on this cultivated olive tree, kind of like in the place where these other branches were snapped off because they lost their salvation. But notice, as he goes through all of these different explanations, he then ends it with a warning. He says in verse 21, for if God did not spare the natural branches, perhaps he will not spare you either. See then the kindness and severity of God, severity toward those who fell, but God's kindness to you, provided you remain in his kindness, otherwise you too will be cut off. So what we see here, I think, two important points, John. Number one is that those Jews had salvation. They had it. They were saved in a certain sense, but then they lost it by rejecting Jesus. And the other thing is, let me finish this, John. The other thing is that these Gentile Christians also have salvation. They have it. They've been grafted in to this tree. They're in Christ. They have this. And yet they're also, St. Paul also warns them that they could lose their salvation if they don't remain in God's grace. That's the upshot of it. But go ahead, John. You had something to say?
But my friends, they haven't rejected Christ.
That's not the point. That's not the point.
The
point is that you can lose your salvation. That's one way of doing it.
Okay. Well, it's maddening because you can't argue with these folks when they're 100% sure that they're saved. It's like once saved, always saved, or something like that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's completely unbiblical. Completely unbiblical.
Yeah, well, okay, well, I will read the passage and pass it on to them.
Yeah, I sense your frustration here. This is by no means the only passage. This is just one of them. I can ply you with many others if that's what you want.
Well, no, one's enough, but I'll read it and digest it, and I don't think I'm going to win the argument though, because their pastor said it, and by God, that's the gospel. So, but thanks for your try, and I'll try too. Okay.
All right. And fair enough. I appreciate it. Thank you. Well, yeah. Here's a word to everybody listening right now. Just remember that no amount of bravado or insistence or, condescending attitude or even anger, for that matter, it doesn't change anything one way or the other as to if a biblical principle is being correctly taught or not. So I understand, as John was referring to, I mean, I've met countless people who are like the ones he's describing, who are just absolutely insistent that they're right, and unwilling to consider the possibility that there's another way to look at these passages. But more often than not, what I've found is that in a case like that, if the Catholic is sufficiently knowledgeable, and it doesn't take a great deal of effort to do that, just to become sufficiently knowledgeable, even to the point of maybe annotating your Bible and highlighting these passages in your Bible and then marking in the notes like the chain references. So when they bring up this passage, okay, this is good, and what are some other passages that will shed light on this? And have those highlighted in your Bible with the chain references so that you know which ones to turn to. That can be very helpful. And many times over the years, what I've discovered is even in the face of, let's say, a Protestant who is convinced that he's correct on this issue, you can show them that in some respects that they are incorrect. And this is where conversions to the church come into play. I've seen it countless times. So my advice would be, know enough to be able to speak intelligently on the topic, be conversant on the topic, have your Bible annotated so that it's in good shape and ready to go. And then you'll find that these kinds of conversations become much more beneficial because you're no longer just sort of arguing back and forth, I think it means this, you think it means that. Eventually, you can make some headway and actually open some locked doors and help the other person move closer to the church or even into the church altogether. It happens all the time. Thank you. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including, and maybe most especially, your phone calls, 888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We are back, as you can probably tell. Hey, I mentioned earlier, Google is your friend. I just did a quick Google search and came up with examples of St. Augustine talking about miracles. There are any number of them, but just for the sake of the gentleman who called earlier, one of them that pops up instantly is in his work, The City of God, probably is, if not his greatest work, one of his greatest works. And this is in chapter 8, and it's under the subtitle of Miracles Which Were Wrought That the World Might Believe in Christ and Which Have Not Ceased Since the World Believed. So in this chapter, he talks about, well, let me just read to you what he says. He says, "Why, they say, are those miracles which you affirm were wrought formerly but wrought no longer? I might indeed reply that miracles were necessary before the world believed in order that it might believe. And whoever nowadays demands to see prodigies that he may believe is himself a great prodigy because he does not believe, though the whole world does. But they may make these objections for the sole purpose of insinuating that even those former miracles were never wrought," wrought being, you know, actually worked. How then is it that everywhere Christ is celebrated with such firm belief in his resurrection and ascension? How is it that in enlightened times," referring to his own day, "in which every impossibility is rejected, the world has, without any miracles, believed things marvelously credible?" And he's referring there to the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly. "Or will they say that these things were credible and therefore were credited? Why then do they themselves not believe? Our argument, therefore, is a summary one. Either incredible things which were not witnessed have caused the world to believe other incredible things which both occurred and were witnessed, or this matter was so credible that it needed no miracles in proof of it, and therefore convicts these unbelievers of unpardonable skepticism. This I might say for the sake of refuting these most frivolous objectors, but we cannot deny that many miracles were wrought to confirm that one grand and health-giving miracle of Christ's ascension to heaven with the flesh in which he rose. For these most trustworthy books of ours contain in one narrative both the miracles that were wrought and the creed which they were wrought to confirm. The miracles were published that they might produce faith, and the faith which they produced brought into greater prominence. For they are read in congregations," he's referring, of course, to the Gospels and the Epistles, "for they are read in the congregations that they may be believed, and yet they would not be so read unless they were believed. For even now, miracles are wrought in the name of Christ, whether by his sacraments or by the prayers or relics of his saints, but they are not so brilliant and conspicuous as to cause them to be published with such glory as accompanied the former miracles." And he goes on and on and on and on and on in that vein. And this is just one passage. So this is not the polemical interaction with the heretic that I had read earlier. This is another example of him saying basically the same thing. So in one sense, he's saying, sure, we still have miracles, but you notice that he associates them with things like the sacraments and such. But he's saying here that it's no longer necessary for there to be these prodigies of miraculous events. They were necessary early on, and Jesus himself confirms that because he performed these miracles that people would believe. But Jesus also said, as blessed are those who have believed without seeing. He said, you believe because you've seen the miracles. You saw me do these things. And you believe because how could you not believe? But blessed are those who do not see and yet still believe. So that might be the undercurrent, you could put it that way, of what St. Augustine is talking about here. So again, City of God is the book. And within that book, it's a book 22. And it's chapter 8 in book 22 of the City of God. And that's just one. There are others, but that's one. And for that matter, it's also not the case that only St. Augustine said this. He's the one that came to mind. I'm looking at a quote here. This is from around the year 125, Father John Hardin. Boy, this is a Freudian slip. Father John Hardin, may he rest in peace. He has an article here about the concept of miracles from the time of St. Augustine to modern apologetics. And he references a quote from Quadratus, who is an early Christian, who had written a defense of Christianity to the Emperor Hadrian. And he says, but the works of our Savior were always present, for they were genuine. Those who were healed and those who rose from the dead, who were seen not only when they were healed and when they were raised, but were constantly present. And not only while the Savior was living, but even after he had gone away, even after he had gone, rather, they were alive for a long time, so that some of them survived even to our own day. I'm presuming he's referring to people like maybe Lazarus. But this issue of miracles and invoking miracles as evidence of Christ's divinity is ancient in its use. It goes back to the very beginning, as you can see here, and also eventually when it seemed as though those vast prodigies began to taper off, then they had to deal with, well, how do you explain that? So hopefully that's helpful. And it was just a simple Google search. And I'll tell you what the terms were that I used. St. Augustine, miracles not necessary. And it pulls up a ton of stuff. Easy, or at least easier. 888-914-9149 is the number. Let's go to Tom now in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Patrick. I have a quick question about receiving communion, and I may not say this perfectly, but I'm wondering how you can be denied receiving communion in one parish or one diocese and be able to receive it in another parish or another diocese.
Well, the simple answer to that, Tom, is because in this case, the diocese or the bishop of the diocese where somebody lives, if he has said you cannot receive Holy Communion, first of all, he's applying the church's law as it stands. He's also following, and I'm thinking about Archbishop Corleone, he's also following the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's instruction on what to do when it comes to somebody like Nancy Pelosi. He's following that. It's interesting, by the way, to note that in the case of Archbishop Corleone, following what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith says to do, not to mention the canon law, and yet it was the people who were super gung-ho about making sure everybody got vaccinated, and if somebody was resistant to that, and I'm talking about COVID, they would scream and jump up and down and pound their fists that you're not following what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith says. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith says get vaccinated, and so they insisted on following that to the letter when it had to do with vaccinations, but they're the same people who are angry and defensive when a bishop does the very same thing, but in this case, on the issue of communion. So why is it? Well, I think it's simple. It's because there are people who, for whatever reason, they disagree with Archbishop Corleone, and they want to promote this idea that it's A-okay to receive communion if you're in the state of mortal sin. Now, I don't know the condition of Nancy Pelosi's soul, but I can only make judgments based on her actions. But her actions suggest to me that she is not repentant of promoting abortion. So to come back to your question, Tom, why does it happen? Because you've got some people who don't look at it the way Archbishop Corleone does, and they're going to do it their way. And it's scandalous, if you ask me.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And here's the thing. I don't really know, but thanks for the call, Tom. I appreciate it. I don't really know what else can be said on this topic. I mean, there's really nothing more to say that I can think of because, you know, it is what it is. And sometimes people are going to do the right thing. Sometimes people are going to do the wrong thing. And thankfully, my job is not to judge anybody, but just leave that to God. That's his job, not mine. In the meantime, though, let's say a prayer for all involved and hope for better days. 888-914-9149. How about Denise in Marshfield, Wisconsin? Hello, Denise.
Oh, stop.
Okay. I'll stop.
Hi.
Hi, Denise. Do I really have to stop? Because I'm enjoying doing the show.
No, I was trying to get my my phone to stop.
Okay.
So I wouldn't get a back feedback. Patrick, did you hear anything about what I might have to speak about or talk about?
No. Go ahead. Okay. Just give it to me straight.
I've often wondered since I've seen the movie and read the book, and I've seen the movie several times, about Saul Alinsky and his infiltration of the Catholic Church, and if he ever had anything to do with the scandal that has plagued our church by promoting priests that were not worthy. I've often wondered about that, if there's any connection between mm-hmm. his infiltration of the church and our scandal that we have such a difficult time with.
It's possible, certainly. Saul Alinsky was just one player in a vast drama of great proportions over a long period of time of people who have wanted to bring the church down by subverting it. Popes have talked about this. So I'm thinking about Pope Leo XIII. I think I talked about this within the last week or so, but just a quick recap. Pope Leo XIII, who composed the prayer to St. Michael the Archangel, and what happened was he had celebrated Mass, and I guess while Mass was over, or when Mass was over and he was making his thanksgivings, God gave him a vision of what the devil would do to the church in the coming century, which was the 20th century. And he was so shaken by this, so appalled at the danger to the church, that he sat down then and there and he composed this prayer to St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle, etc. And so he talked about this with his advisors and the people who were there. He comes to mind, Pope St. Pius X, he saw very clearly the infiltration of modernism into the Catholic Church and all of the insidious ways in which the church could be subverted through that heretical mindset. And it wasn't just one particular thing. Modernism, it extends to many different areas of subversion of the church, but he wrote a great length on this topic, very publicly about it, condemning it. More recently, we see Pope Paul VI in the 1970s, and he said that he could see that the smoke of Satan had entered even into the sanctuary of the church, and he's speaking metaphorically there. By saying even into the sanctuary, it seems pretty clear that he means even into, like, you know, the hierarchy. So we have these papal statements and others besides that warn about this kind of thing taking place. So not to minimize the damage that Saul Alinsky did as an agitator and as a theorist, but really, honestly, he's only one small player in a much bigger cast of characters. So did he personally have anything to do with the scandals and things? Very possibly. There is a fictional book, and it was it came out, as I recall, in the early 1970s, and it was written in such a fashion as it was like the memoirs of a man who had died in a car accident, or he died shortly after a car accident, and the woman who sort of stumbled upon the accident found his briefcase, and then took these papers and turned it into like a published book. And that book is called AA 1025. Now, it's fiction, but it's fiction based upon things like the testimony of various people who said that there was this concerted effort to introduce into the church Freemasons, atheists, communists, etc. And that book, AA 1025, The Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle, sort of distills this game plan that some people say took place. So I mean, I suppose I could talk for quite a long time on this topic, but just to say that what you're saying is not kooky or conspiracy theory or anything like that. It's something that even popes have talked about, and we would do well to be aware of that. But ultimately, and I come back to this again, ultimately, Denise, there's no need for you and for me to be anxious or in turmoil over this. We can acknowledge it as a problem, but the key for you and for me is not to go down the rabbit hole of all the genuine conspiracy theories, whether they're real or not, and focus our minds on Jesus and doing what we're supposed to be doing, being a good husband, being a good wife, good father, good mother, good radio host, good whatever, and loving God with all of our heart, mind, and strength, loving our neighbor as ourselves, giving alms, receive the sacraments, pray, all of these things. And I find personally, Denise, that is very liberating because I know ultimately I can't do anything about the problem one way or the other. And I'm probably not even fully conscious of how extensive it may be, but God is. And so let's just leave everything in his hands. You know what I'm saying? I've got to take a break in a second. Did you want to have a follow-up?
Okay. I just want to make one comment. I know of people that walked away from the church after this last large scandal. And
we
I
all
think,
do.
Like, what are they missing?
We all do.
And I guess we just continue to pray for them and for our priests and for our hierarchy, you know. So thank you.
All of them. All of the above and for ourselves. But let's keep our eyes fixed on Christ. And no matter what happens, church politics doesn't matter, whatever, no matter what happens, if you're close to Jesus and you're moving forward in faith, it's going to be okay. And we'll leave everything in his hands. And pray, pray, pray. Thank you. I'll be right back with more right after this.